Well, hello and welcome back to the Elimination of Bias, Part 2. We're coming to you live in a conference call this evening on June 27th, 2018. And we are also recording the program for purposes of a future podcast. In our first part of the program, we gave just kind of an introduction of the history behind this elimination of bias CLE requirement in Minnesota, and talked a little bit about some of the historical background of the requirement. And we started looking into some of the reports from various listening sessions that have been held by the courts throughout the state over the last several years. Yesterday we talked about some things like the necessity of having a court staff and a bench and a bar and that somewhat matches the community to add credibility to the system, if nothing else, if not actual fairness, even if we have achieved that actual fairness, which of course is arguable, but even if we have achieved that actual fairness, we also have to be very concerned about having a perception of fairness, because we as attorneys gain our livelihood from being part of a system that people generally trust for redress of their grievances. And if we reach the point where a large enough portion of the population does not have a trust in that system, we have failed, and people will start redressing their grievances using other means. And just from a purely selfish point of view, that means that we as attorneys will have nothing to do. From that purely selfish point of view, or certainly from the point of view of concerned citizens who want to make sure that we do, in fact, have a rule of law within our system, I think it's an important topic to talk about. We looked at some of the other observations made at some of these community meetings, and I'm going to jump ahead a little bit because there's so much material here that we could certainly talk for well over 2 hours about it. The items that I have are here in no particular order, so that means some of the important ones are at the end. So we're going to jump ahead several pages. Let's see to I think page 11 in your course materials, where we have the topic of racial profiling, which I think is a very important topic to talk about. Now. The importance of this topic was really driven home to me because about 2 years ago was the last time I gave a live presentation of this particular program to a group of attorneys, and that was about June 2016, near the end of the reporting cycle 2 years ago. We had an audience of attorneys in Minneapolis. We were talking about this, like I say, at the end of June 2016. And one hypothetical that I always had always mentioned at these programs, I mentioned something along the lines of me driving around my neighborhood with a burnt-out taillight. Now, I've been known to, if I ever have a burnt-out taillight, it's maybe not the most pressing emergency situation for me to deal with, so perhaps there have been times when I've driven around for a few days with a burnt-out taillight. And I've always, with any time that I've ever driven around with a burnt-out taillight, I have done so with impunity. So I oftentimes had brought up that that hypothetical of me driving around with a burnt-out taillight, and nothing really comes of it. I'm a responsible citizen, so eventually I will get to the service station or the auto parts store and get the replacement for that taillight. Sometimes I let it go for a little while, and that's never really caused me very much trouble. Well, I contrasted that with a hypothetical example of somebody else driving around with a burnt out taillight, of an African American person driving around with a burnt out taillight. And as you can see from these many anecdotal reports from around the state, a person of color driving around with a burnt out taillight, that is a pressing issue because for whatever reason, that person is much more likely to be pulled over and to have contact with law enforcement as a result of that burnt out taillight. And of course, that affects us as attorneys because that means that there's a higher possibility that that person will be involved in the justice system in one way or another. It has no impact upon me because I don't get pulled over for my burnt out taillight. An African American person or somebody who maybe looks different from what the average look in the community is runs a risk of getting pulled over for that burnt out taillight. And like I say, I gave that example 2 years ago in June 2016. And also, when I give that hypothetical, I am, and when I talk about myself driving around with a burnt-out taillight, I'm thinking of myself driving around my neighborhood in St. Paul, and one of the streets that I drive on a pretty much daily basis is Larpinder Avenue. I live just a couple of blocks from there, and it's pretty much on a daily basis I'm driving down Larpinder Avenue. For one reason or another, well, sometimes I've done that with a burnt out taillight, usually without any concern. So anyway, 2 years ago I gave this hypothetical, as I gave the hypothetical, the little mental picture of myself was me driving down Larpinder Avenue with a burnt out taillight. About less than a week, about a week after I gave that CLE program, I forget whether it was late June or early July, sure enough, an African American person was driving down Larpinder Avenue, and the subsequent facts revealed that there were probably there might have been additional reasons why that person was pulled over. But one of the reasons, and certainly one of the original stated reasons that came out, was because that person had a burnt out taillight. That was an African American named Philando Castile, about 2 miles away from where I live, where I have driven many times with a burnt out taillight, and he was shot and unfortunately died as a result of that. The officer involved was charged and he was acquitted in Ramsey County. Nobody would question whether or not somebody questions whether there should have been conviction in that case. Nobody questions that officer's life was not truly in danger. There was a weapon in the vehicle for which he had a permit, but there was no indication whatsoever that it was pointed at the officer or anything like that. In 2020 hindsight, anybody looking at that situation probably came to the conclusion that the officer's perception that he was in fear for his life was indeed mistaken. That this truly was a tragic accident, and that it should not have happened. Again, no matter what your view of the culpability of that individual officer, I think it's pretty safe to say that if the skin color of that driver being pulled over had been different. Maybe not a sure thing, but it's certainly very likely that the outcome of that case might have been very different. Because, again, as we look through these various anecdotal accounts from all around the state that you see quoted here, one of them was a group of kids playing in a park. The perception was, not that it was kids playing in the park, but that it was some kind of gang activity or whatever. you know, there's a perception based upon what people look like. And no matter how much of a skeptic you might be, including myself, I'm a skeptic when it comes to things like that, you have to conclude that there must be a certain amount of truth to it, because African Americans and other minorities are much more likely to attract the attention of law enforcement than I am, as I drive with my burnt out taillight down that same street. In fact, a couple of hours ago, I was driving past the very point where that took place. I did not have a burnt out taillight today, but if I had, it's quite likely that that I would not have been pulled over. So why is that? We just did the easy part. We identified that, yes, I think there is racial profiling going on. But the response is, well, what can we do about it? Well, now, it's easy to say, well, there's obviously racism, and we have to get rid of this racism. So in other words, there are racist cops out there, and let's get rid of the racist cops. Well, I have some good news and bad news when we make that observation. The good news is that, well, I don't think there are that many racist cops. But that's also the bad news. Because if there were a significant number of cops who were simply racist, or judges, or attorneys, or whatever category is engaging this racial profiling, if they're simply racist, well, then it's the easiest problem in the world to solve. All we have to do is identify those racist persons in power, simply fire them, and then the problem is solved. It's the easiest problem in the world to solve. So if you think I'm wrong, that it's not actually overt racism on the part of people, if you think I'm wrong, that's an extraordinarily good thing, because that makes the problem much easier to solve. All we have to do is get rid of those troublemakers. But unfortunately, I don't think I am wrong, because I know a lot of cops, and I have never met a single one that for whatever reason seems to be racist. Most of them are fair-minded people. They are trying to do their job, and I don't think it's a case of overt racism that they're looking for trouble in that way. So then, why is it? Well, and I think the reason is it means that it's not as easy a problem to solve. But I think what it is those police officers probably have a background pretty similar to mine. They have the same kind of upbringing, the same kind of background, the same kind of life experience, kind of a typical middle-class suburban background. I think they probably have a similar background to what I have. That didn't make me a racist, having that kind of a background. It didn't make them a racist, but it did make me see things in the world a little bit differently. So let me tell you a little bit about my background. I graduated from Minneapolis Edison High School in 1979, late 70s. So I grew up in Northeast Minneapolis. Today, Northeast Minneapolis is a very diverse community. All kinds of people from all over the world, all colors, all races, all nationalities, very diverse neighborhood. But at the time when I grew up, that was simply not the case. It was not a diverse neighborhood, not because we were all racist, although it turns out I've heard things subsequently that leads me to believe that there actually were a fair number of people who were racist. I heard many, many years after the fact of things like cross burnings, not very many, but enough. And I also heard somebody recounted a story that they were a little kid playing in the neighborhood, and somebody who was looking to buy a house in the neighborhood came over to talk to the kids who were playing. And the first thing, or at least the thing that this person remembered as a child being asked by this person thinking of moving in the neighborhood, are there any black people in the neighborhood? apparently there is, there was a certain amount of overt racism. But for the most part, it wasn't overt racism, or at least I can only vouch for myself, it wasn't overt racism on my part. But it was a completely white neighborhood. There was not a single African American person, period, in the neighborhood. In fact, the 13 years that I went through the Minneapolis public schools, from grades kindergarten through 12, I encountered a grand total of one African American student in all that time, and that was actually a kid who was adopted. So it was a white family that happened to have an African American kid, but zero black students in my school. Now that's changed a great deal over the years, but that's the way it was at the time. So my experience, my life experience, is for 18 years of growing up, my life experience was, what do other people look like? What do other people look like? Well, they have skin about the same color as mine, and 100% of them do. That's what a member of the community looks like. That's a normal-looking person. Now, I have today things are very, very different, I live in a much more diverse neighborhood now. The old neighborhood where I grew up is also much more diverse, so that has changed a great deal. But my background is the norm, a member of the community. What does a member of the community look like? If I make a mental picture of what the typical person in the community looks like, well, I am going to see a white person. But what does that mean? That means that if I, instead of becoming a lawyer, had become a police officer, well, then I'm driving down the street in my squad car. I am going to, not because of any ill intent on my part, but I am going to notice the things that are out of the ordinary. I am going to notice the things and the people that do not normally belong there. To a certain extent, the white people will become invisible to me because they're just part of the background. But this something different, this unusual-looking thing, namely somebody with skin that's a different shade than mine, that's the thing that I'm going to notice. I am going to see that. Maybe, not consciously, I'm not going to pay any attention to it, but that's the thing I'm going to notice. Those are the people that I'm going to notice. I'm going to unconsciously spend more of my time paying attention to the things that I notice as opposed to the things that I don't notice. And you, if you're an African American, you are one of the things that I notice. I don't start out with any intention of treating you any differently, but I just notice you more. So if you were driving down the street, and I happen to have my, be paying attention to you because, something different, something new, well, I'm going to notice that your taillight is burnt out. Whereas that invisible person driving down the street, that person who looks like me, I'm not going to be paying much attention to them, so I'm not going to see their taillight that is burnt out. In either case, when I notice that your taillight is burnt out, my sworn duty is to enforce the traffic laws of the state. So my duty is to pull you over as soon as I notice that you have a burnt out taillight. But the likelihood of me noticing that taillight being burnt out by the African-American person is probably much greater than the burnt out taillight of the white person. So that's probably not the only issue. I think it would be naive to say that that's the only thing going on. But just the fact that that I notice you more because you're different, I'm going to unconsciously pay more attention to you. Now, what's the solution to that, though? Again, it would be an extraordinarily easy solution if we simply said that, let's find all the racist cops and fire them, or find all the racist judges and fire them, or find all the racist lawyers and fire them. That would be easy, simple, and once it's done, it's done. This is not quite so easy because that's true of me, I notice some people a little bit more, therefore I'm going to notice their taillights burnt out a little bit more. It's probably true of you, though, and it's probably true of everyone. So therefore, it's not quite so easy, because if we fire everybody who has that tendency, which seems to me to be just simple human nature, if we fire everybody with that tendency, well, then we'll have to fire everybody. So we can't solve the problem that way. And I don't think we can solve the problem by imposing some kind of rules on other people. I think the way to solve that problem is for all of us to recognize that we have certain propensities, because you grew up in one kind of background. Some things look normal to you. I grew up in a different background. So I don't know how we can solve that, but I think the fact that we have to recognize that in ourselves is probably kind of a first step. At this point, I am going to give our first code number for this second hour of the program. And our first code number is B569. B as in bias, 569. B569 is the first code number for this hour of the bias program. B569. So again, I don't know if that this issue does not avail of itself of an easy solution. But if you look through here, I have about two pages of anecdotes of people pointing out that yes, I'm more likely to attract the attention of law enforcement because I don't look like the average member of the community. As you read these, it seems like the same story repeated over and over, with only minor details changing. So yes, I think it's safe to say there is something called racial profiling. I don't know what we can do to solve it as a system, but I think what we can do to solve it individually, because I want to be fair-minded, you want to be fair-minded. We don't want to be biased against any group, and also if we're concerned about the traffic laws being enforced, that means there are a lot of people who look like me driving around with burnt out taillights with impunity. I think the first step is simply that we have to recognize that we have propensities. And mine are going to be different from yours. If you are an African-American person, you grew up in an African-American neighborhood, it's probably going to be the exact opposite. You will probably, if you become a police officer, you're probably going to notice my taillight more than somebody else's, which also means that perhaps it ties in a little bit with the topic we were talking about yesterday. Maybe there is a reason why the fact that the color of your skin or your background or your nationality, maybe that is something that we should take into account in the hiring process so that, you know, if we really want to enforce the taillight laws in this state, if there were more African-American officers out there, they would probably notice my taillight. You know, having a good mix within the community so that you have you're likely to encounter a police officer or a judge or an attorney with a background somewhat similar to yours. So not only can they relate to you better, but it just makes for better policing. It makes for better judging. It makes for better lawyering to be able to have that kind of diverse background. So that's why, like I say, I think I've come around a little bit on the topic we talked about yesterday, employing people of color. Even if we want to call that affirmative action. Maybe that's the reason why I've come around a little bit, but that might be maybe that is a logical thing that that perhaps makes you the most qualified person for the job. On kind of a related note, flipping back in the materials to where we left off yesterday, we left off with hire more people of color and appoint more minority judges. Kind of a related note is the makeup of juries, because I don't know if there's I don't know about the evidence of this as far as numbers, but there is a perception in many members of the community, particularly here, particularly Native Americans were the ones who brought this up, but also other parts of the community. There is a perception, anyway, that people like me are less likely to be serving on juries. So in some place like Pine County, where it was brought up, fairly large Native American community, there was at least a perception that that Native Americans were underrepresented on the in the jury pool. As you see, that that same issue came up at a number of other venues. And one possible reason for that, that I kind of identified myself, and then I see in this Rochester 2016 meeting, some of the participants brought that up, is that in Minnesota, there are two ways that you can get your name in the jury pool. First of all is having either a Minnesota driver's license or state ID. Well, that's kind of a new one, but traditionally, the way that you got on the jury pool was being a registered voter. For until probably 30 years ago, that was the only source of jurors. They used the voter registration list. Well, that that is a little bit problematic in Minnesota because even though we vote a lot here, there are a lot of people who are not registered voters because you can register at the polling place. So there have been many times in my life, even though I vote in every single election, there have been many times, or a few times anyway, where I have not been a registered voter because if I move, there is no need for me to go through the process of becoming a registered voter because I know that I can simply register at the polls. And the only place I have registered to vote in my adult life has been at the polling place. You just get there, allow a little extra time, show your ID, and you can register right there and you vote right away. So there's no need to pre-register. Well, so that means if I move a year before the election, I'm not a registered voter. I'm not a registered voter until the next election. So the list of registered voters is kind of problematic because we have a very mobile society and a lot of people are not registered voters even though they are civic-minded citizens who will vote in the next election because they know full well that they can register at the polling place. So to maybe recognizing that or maybe just out of sheer luck, a few decades ago, the law was changed that now voter registration is also, or jury obligation is also based upon having a Minnesota driver's license or state ID card. So they combine those two lists, the list of registered voters and the list of people with Minnesota driver's license or state ID cards. But not everybody has one of those. Most people have a driver's license because most people drive. Not all people drive, though. In fact, that's one thing where society is changing. There's actually a growing, you know, when you and I were in high school, we got our, you know, probably got our driver's license shortly after turning 16. That was kind of the norm. That's actually changing quite a bit. There are a fair number of kids who graduate from high school these days who do not have a driver's license because it's, you know, you just call Uber or whatever. It's not as big a deal. It strikes me as weird that that's happening, but there actually is a larger and larger contingent of people without driver's licenses. Well, most of those people, if they don't have a driver's license, eventually will get a Minnesota state ID card because you need that for many purposes for ID. It used to be, you know, you needed it for ID to cash a check or something. Well, nobody cashes checks anymore. You have a debit card. So there's probably even a growing number of people who just put off going to the step of getting the state ID card. or maybe if they're 19 years old, you know, they think, well, I'll get my driver's license next year, so I'm not going to bother getting the state ID card. So there are larger and larger numbers of people who do not have a driver's license or a state ID card. And that might be disproportionately some races and ethnic groups that do not have a driver's license or a state ID card. One in particular where it was pointed out was in Hinckley, was that a lot of Native Americans who don't drive do not necessarily have a Minnesota state ID card because they have a tribal ID. So they don't, for identification purposes, they really do not need that Minnesota state ID card. The tribal ID card serves perfectly well for those purposes. But other people, even in other areas, for whatever reason, do not have a driver's license or a state ID card. So therefore, that's a topic that maybe I think our policymakers need to take a look at. Where are jury pools drawn from? Because we want not only fairness, but we want a perception of fairness. We want to make sure that the potential jurors are a broad cross-section of the public. Personally, I think we should have 12-person juries in any kind of criminal case. But especially if you have only have 6 people in a misdemeanor case or something, you really have the potential of just the odds of having 6 very different people with different outlooks. I think the chances go way down, and it goes down even more if some portion of the public is being excluded. Like maybe that 19-year-old who has neither a driver's license nor a state ID, I can think of many, many people who might be in that situation of not having one of those documents. So, like I say, in my previous renditions of this program, I've brought this up. At the listening session held in Rochester in 2016, the subject also came up there, and it looks like people were kind of brainstorming on what kind of databases can be mined to get names of potential jurors. So phone numbers, student IDs, public, utility bills, because just about anybody who lives in any kind of a dwelling is going to be paying some kind of utility bill. Everybody has a cell phone, I think maybe it is time to use a little bit more creativity to broaden the net of who we call for jury duty. Let's see, we're about halfway through. I'm going to give the second code number at this point. Our next code number for this hour of the program is B520 is the second code number for this portion of the program. Let's see, we're not, in our remaining half hour here, we're not going to get through all the material here, so we'll kind of hit the high points of some of them that are here. Maybe at some point we'll do a third hour of the Elimination of Bias program. Court access was an issue that came up many places, kind of a feeling in many parts of the state that the courthouse is simply not a very user-friendly building. Now, again, we might be able to look at that and say, well, wait a minute, that has nothing whatsoever to do with bias, because if we have poor architecture in the courthouse, that affects everybody equally. And that might be true, but again, remember, people were asked here, tell us about your experiences with bias in the court system. So at the very least, first of all, if it's an improvement we can make to the justice system, well, we should think about doing those improvements. But there's a perception, though, that it's biased. And again, I think that perception of whether our system is fair or not is an important concern. So, again, just the physical plans of the courthouse, people not being able to find where things are. And usually the, any kind of a court appearance usually involves a fair amount of motion around the building. You know, you check in at the front desk of the clerk's office, and you're told, to go to this floor, and you have to, find out what courtroom you are in by looking at the monitor, and then you have to go to that courtroom. If you have to pay a fine or file some documents, you go to a different place. And a lot of people are overwhelmed by that process. So at a minimum, one of the places mentioned, maybe we need to have better signage. Somebody mentioned our state court system, I think, has done a really good job of having self-help information available on the Internet. There's a kind of a wealth of information there for pro se litigants to be able to find information. But there's even some talk at this Fridley session of maybe augmenting that, making it better, getting the public libraries involved. Be proactive about training librarians to say, for your legal needs, this is the website you have to use, and help steer people toward those self-help resources, even if it doesn't amount to, the practice of law, but at least being able to direct people in the right direction where they can find that information. So court access is an important issue, and as you can see, there are quite a few comments regarding that. One of those comments is kind of interesting, that came up a couple of places, came up in Hastings, I know the first time we talked, when I've done this program, I mentioned that this topic had been brought up in Hastings, and I pointed out that I bet this is also an issue in Anoka and Stillwater. And sure enough, at the listening session here in Fridley in 2017, somebody pointed out the exact same thing about the Anoka County Courthouse. And what is it about those courthouses? What is it about the Dakota County Courthouse in Hastings, the Anoka County Courthouse in Anoka, and probably, I'm guessing, the Washington County Courthouse or Government Center in Stillwater? What do those buildings have in common? Well, it's either impossible or extraordinarily difficult to get there on the bus. Because if you are driving around and you get a speeding ticket in Columbia Heights or Oakdale or Apple Valley someplace, Dakota County, that's a bad example because they have a courthouse in Apple Valley also. But I suspect getting to the Apple Valley Courthouse is also maybe a little bit problematic. If you get involved in the criminal justice system or the civil justice system for whatever reason, getting to court can be an ordeal. If you don't have a car or if you're not legally allowed to be driving a car, maybe because of your difficulties, that can be an issue. It's really not possible to get there on the bus, or at least it's extraordinarily difficult. What does that have to do with bias? Well, first of all, again, there's a perception that it has something to do with bias, but it seems to me that might have kind of a disproportionate impact based upon race, because if you live in Minneapolis or St. Paul, you're probably more likely to be a minority if you live in Minneapolis or St. Paul, if you live in the city, even if your business might take you into the inner ring suburbs on occasion, even though maybe you go to work in Fridley or Oakdale or something, so you're kind of close in, but suddenly if you get pulled over for some traffic offense or something in one of those areas, suddenly you have a new very important place that you have to be, and that's the courthouse in Fridley or in Anoka or in Stillwater or in Hastings or something, and you can't get there on the bus. So there's a fair number of people apparently who miss court appearances for that reason. So is that a soluble problem? Well, I don't know for sure, but it's at least something we should think about. When we locate a new courthouse, we should make sure that there is some way for people to get there. Not just criminal defendants, but anybody having to do business with the county should make sure that that's a possible for them to do. So it has to go into our planning process. I don't know exactly what the solution is. We can't have a special shuttle bus just for people going to the courthouse. I don't think we can. Maybe we can. Maybe allowing more and more things to be done remotely rather than demanding a personal appearance at the courthouse. So it's an issue we have to keep in mind. Now, that's probably not something that you and I can do a lot about, but our people, if you're involved in the planning process, either for transit or for locating the new courthouse, I think that certainly should be an issue that you give some consideration to. Interestingly, one of the more recent listening sessions in Anoka pointed out something that I noticed. There's not a lot of parking around the Anoka County Courthouse. There is a ramp, actually, that's actually quite convenient out there, but the people pointing out, oh, they might get ticketed if they park in the two-hour area, and they're actually there for more than 2 hours. And one time I was representing somebody in a DWI, and sure enough, he'd parked in the two-hour area. So there was a break in the proceedings, and my client announced to me, I have to go out and move my car. I pointed out to him, well, wait a minute, you're not even supposed to be driving a car. So because I'm a full-service attorney, I said, well, here, give me your keys. I'll go move your car for you. And then I elicited a promise from him that he would have a friend to come and pick up his car and he would not drive off. You know, there's a limit to what I can do. But it's a very real issue. You're supposed to be at the courthouse out there in Anoka, and you're not allowed to drive a car. How do you get there? And you should have called me. I would have given him a ride there probably, but for whatever reason he didn't. And certainly somebody who's not represented by an attorney is probably not going to have that option. So again, it's an issue that should be considered. The next topic that came up many places is affordability of the court system, or what I applied to it here, that it's a revolving door. Because what happens is, somebody gets in some small trouble with the law. They get a speeding ticket, or they get in some trouble and they have to pay a fine. Well, they can't afford to pay the fine. So, well, what happens if you can't afford to pay the fine? There's a warrant issued for your arrest. And then you get arrested. And then you're in jail. And then you lose your job. And then you don't have any money to pay the fine. So it becomes kind of a vicious circle. And again, certainly if you commit some kind of infraction, you should be prepared to pay the fine. But for whatever reason, not everybody is able to. And there's a huge popular perception out there in some parts of the community that this system is just this revolving door or this endless treadmill that it's impossible to get off. Because once you get in the system, you're stuck because you can't pay the fine. Well, there's another fine for not paying the fine or whatever, or possibility of a bench warrant being issued. So it is an issue. And some of the counties are addressing that by having a day when you can, kind of an amnesty day when you can come in and fess up and get any warrants taken care of and get it all resolved in one day in kind of a manageable package, so that somebody can realistically pay their debt to society rather than uh, rather than just having this overwhelming obligation that they will never be able to satisfy, that just keeps them trapped in the system perpetually. So again, there's even whether it's true or untrue, there's this perception out there that the court system are a revolving door. And again, we ought to be very concerned about those perceptions and whether or not the system is fair, but whether it has a perception of fairness. Kind of on the related note, a lot of people brought up the fact that perhaps there should be specialized courts for specialized practice areas, so that one judge can be an expert in a certain area rather than just so that one judge can pay more of a personal interest in cases. Rather than you show up in the courthouse and it's a different judge every day, you have to kind of relearn what's going on and cannot apply any particular expertise. A lot of people brought up the fact of bail and sentencing practices, is there disparity in those? Now, I'm kind of inclined to say that no, there's probably not a lot of disparity because to a certain extent, our judges are very much bound by the sentencing guidelines, and they don't have a great deal of discretion. So even if you wanted to have a disparate impact as a judge, you would have a hard time doing that because the sentencing guidelines are usually so narrow. But on the other hand, judges do have a certain amount of discretion, and certainly prosecutors have a certain amount of discretion as to what charges will be brought. And there is that perception out there that there's a disparate impact, that minorities receive greater sentences may have to come up with higher amounts of bail than a similarly situated non-minority person. So again, there's that perception is out there, and we need to be aware of that. I don't sentence people, I don't set bail, so it's probably not something that you and I, as individual attorneys, can counter. But I think to the extent that we are decision makers within that system, we should be constantly vigilant of that, I think. So, but that was brought up a lot of places, and also the. When it comes to bail, again, we have bail guidelines, too. I think I'm not an expert on them, but we have bail guidelines that don't give a lot of discretion to the judge. But to the extent that the judge has discretion, he or she is going to base that discretion on his or her knowledge of the community, his or her knowledge of human behavior. And so if I was a judge and I was setting bail, and somebody who lives in my neighborhood who has a similar background to me, if that person I have to set bail, I kind of know the factors that I keep in mind when I decide how reliable somebody is. I would look at their family situation, I would look at their employment situation, I would look at the things that I use to assess character. To decide really the only thing that I'm supposed to keep in mind when setting bail is what amount do I have to set it at to guarantee that this person will appear for trial. I'm probably pretty good at that with people who are similar to me, but I'm probably not very good at making those character judgments on somebody who has a very different background from me. So I might set the bail low on people where I think the person will appear for trial, and I judge them wrong, and they skip bail. Or I might set the bail much too high on somebody, they would have appeared for trial even if I had set the bail at a reasonable amount. So it's something we have to be mindful of, and I think, again, it kind of goes back to it gives us a great advantage if the judge and the court staff has a diverse viewpoint, has many kinds of different backgrounds making up our courts, so that those kind of judgments can intelligently be made. It just makes our system better to have it you know, different points of view represented from within the court system. So anyway, but that was brought up a number of places. One, and this one's getting kind of old. This was Rochester in about 2008, and so maybe the makeup of Rochester is completely different by now, because this is maybe 10 years ago. But at the time, there was a large Somali population in Rochester, and I think there probably is, but now there are probably other large populations there as well. One of the listening sessions was held at the in the cafeteria of a school where a lot of the Somali kids went to school, and the audience at this listening session was made up mostly of parents of those kids, one of the issues that they identified, and this was Somalis in Rochester in the 2000s, 2010 probably around there, this is absolutely nothing new, is that, this country is made up of immigrants. In my case, my grandparents immigrated here from somewhere else. Today we have a lot of other people. So this, my grandparents probably would have said the same thing, 100 years ago. Now it's Somalis in Rochester saying this, and this is a problem of self-correcting. But if you immigrate to this country as an adult, it will always be a foreign country to you. You will never totally understand our language or our culture or our institutions or anything. Whereas if you come here as a small child, or if you are born here, you will have a very different experience from your parents, and you will know our culture and our values and our language and our institutions. You will understand those things very well, even if we tried to prevent that, it would be impossible, once we plop you in public school for 13 years, you're going to turn into an American, even if we tried not to. Well, the result of that, though, is when the kid gets to their teen years or so, they're going to have a pretty good understanding of how American institutions work. That will probably be a better understanding than what their parents have. As a result, that's not a recipe for great parenting when your kids understand things better than you do. So what these parents in Rochester said, we need some kind of a link between these two cultures. And what they identified was perhaps there should be a Somali-American liaison officer in the public schools. Maybe that police officer there could be somebody who understands both American law and institutions, and also the Somali culture. Now, at the time when they made that suggestion, and they probably around 2010 or so, there probably weren't very many Somali police officers who had gone through the system. Now there probably are many, many more. In fact, probably to the point where I'm guessing the Somalis in Rochester probably would not be saying this. But other cultures, other newer cultures as they come here, That first wave of immigrants until that first generation of kids comes of age, that's an ongoing problem. Because you want the parents to have greater understanding of the institutions than the kids do, because otherwise it's not a method of a very good parenting. At this point, I'm going to give our next code number. For the third code number for this hour of the program is B575. B575. B575 is our next code number. So what can we do about it? We can educate people, and that is the next topic that came up, because it's clear that the people who do not have a lot of understanding of the system want to have it. Very clear. They're asking for it here. making comments such as, why can't there be more programming on our foreign language cable TV station about the American legal system. Now one of the things we can do about it is that doesn't have to be an official undertaking of the Bar Association. You can go down to your especially if you have any language ability or interaction with other members of the culture, go down and volunteer to do the Focus on the Law cable TV access show to help educate, let people know what the system is. But I don't know, probably most of us are not going to be doing that. But maybe what we can do is, there are our day-to-day, ventures out into the community. If you're like me, you've discovered we do live in a very diverse community right now. And another lawyer pointed this out to me, that most people know a lawyer. Because people have legal questions from now and then. They got some paper from the insurance company, and they don't know what to do about it. So they talk to their lawyer friend. So for your friends, they come to you, and you occasionally are called upon to dispense free legal advice. Often you don't even think of it in terms of being formal legal advice, because it might be as simple as, I really don't practice in that particular area, so I don't know how to help you with your real estate transaction, but here's the name of an attorney I do know. You'll at least kind of steer them in the right direction. And it turns out that we as attorneys, that's one of the things we do. We do provide kind of that gatekeeping function. Because this attorney pointed it out to me, and the more I was looking for that, I'm doing it all the time. I'm kind of this legal gatekeeper, that my friends come to me with their informal legal questions, and I will either give them an answer like, you don't have to worry about that, or maybe steer them in the right direction, or maybe on rare occasions it'll turn into a formal attorney-client relationship. But most times it is not. Most times it's just a very informal kind of thing. And it turns out that most citizens have such a person that they can turn to. Most members of the community have somebody that they can go to who is their lawyer friend. For some people, that's you. They go to you, you're the lawyer friend, for asking that. Certainly in various ethnic communities, have that lawyer friend now. For example, certainly in the Hmong community that has been, part of Minnesota culture for decades now, there are many Hmong kids who have gone to law school and have become attorneys and judges and police officers. So an elderly member of the Hmong community, even if they do not speak English, they have a lawyer friend that they can go to because they've been here for 30 years. They've had time to graduate their kids into attorneys. So they now have that lawyer friend. But on the other hand, there are communities that do not, because they simply have not been here long enough for that to happen on a natural basis. And some of them are probably people that you interact with on a regular basis. So when you go into the convenience store to pay for your gas, that person, perhaps he's a member of a well-established community that has kids who have graduated from high school here and gone on to law school, and perhaps he has a lawyer friend, but it's also possible that person does not have a lawyer friend. So I guess the one thing that you and I can do to improve the situation in this state is to maybe be the lawyer friend for those for people. And make it aware, make people aware of the fact that you're an attorney. And again, just that humility, just that openness that we talked about at the beginning of yesterday's program. Just, you know, that willingness to befriend someone make sure that they know that you're a lawyer. Maybe it'll turn into a good business venture too, because you know, then you'll be the paying lawyer that they'll come to for their formal legal needs. But more likely, it'll simply be you will be that gatekeeper to the legal system. So if they do have some real legal problem, you'll be able to steer them in the right direction, because if they have you, they will have somebody they can turn to. So just, I think, part of the solution to how can we eliminate bias, how can we eliminate some of these problems, not all these problems, might just boil down to this sense of humble friendship that we talked about yesterday. That might be able to make a difference. We are almost at an hour here, so I am going to give our final code number for this hour of the program. Our final code number for the program is B518. B518. B518 is our last code number. B518. Some of the topics we did not talk about, and you can look through these, immigration and collateral consequences, obviously a major issue today. We did talk about racial profiling. Language barriers, talk about the need for interpreters. In fact, I might in the near future have another program talking specifically about working with interpreters and how to make that situation better. We talked a little bit about some of the concerns expressed specifically by Native Americans, and one that comes up a lot in places like Bemidji and Pine County and outstate Minnesota, and certainly in the Twin Cities too. One issue that's often brought up there is, can we make a greater use of tribal resources? So anyway, that does bring us to the end of the second hour of Bias 2018. Again, once you've listened to all the segments, you can email those code numbers to me at clem.law@usa.net, clem.law@usa.net, and I will get your certificate of attendance to you. Also, if you have any substantive questions or comments about the program, feel free to send those to the same address, and I will get back with you probably the same day, or at least within the amount of time permitted by the rules for responding to questions. I'm always happy to hear from people, either with questions or just any comments you might have, and oftentimes those comments get incorporated into future programs. So I always enjoy hearing those. And for more information about this program and other programs, please visit my website at richardclem.com. It's richardclem.com, and you can find information on all of my programs here. So thank you once again, and have a great day.